Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world. With your hosts, C. Derek Barn and Amog Sahu.
This is the second part of a conversation with the host of the Regrettable Century podcast on revolutionary pessimism and our current moment.
When we say DSA as it's presently constituted is not long for this world, that should be something that is just as potentially exciting for everyone in DSA as it is potentially, you know, a reason to bite your nails.
Yeah, that's exactly what DSA is. It is a more politically sophisticated version of Occupy Wall Street.
You know what I consider it? The new version of the original SDS, because you're about the same size.
Yeah,
That sounds accurate.
You do have more non-student components than the SDS does, but you don't have any unions or anything to help out like they did.
Right.
Yeah. No, exactly. Well, to that end, this is the importance of base building. One, but two, there are at least some. I am personally aware of some initial steps toward collaboration on common projects with labor unions currently existing with DSA locals, and that is really hopeful.
That's good. I am one of those people who has. I will admit I have left communist tendencies from labor unions from actually being involved with them.
Yeah.
And business unions are super, super frustrating.
Yeah, they are.
Oh, yeah. Jason went to organizing school for the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, I have my – we probably share many of the same frustrations. I was also once a part of a union that did not advocate for collective bargaining because we didn't have it, and they thought, we'll figure out a way to get what we need. We haven't.
I was a part of a union in the South as a teachers union that didn't have collective bargaining legally and actually couldn't even call itself a union legally. It had to call itself an association.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's all it really was without collective bargaining, right?
Right. I remember talking to our organizer when Jason and I were both involved in the same union in Texas. And we just kind of casually made the comment, you know, like, oh, it's really, you know, shitty that we don't have collective bargaining rights in Texas, right? And he's like, well, would you really want to go on strike and let old people in state-run nursing homes just die? I'm like,
yes.
Yes, dude. Yeah,
if the question must be framed in that way, then the answer must be yes.
And also, normally, just historically speaking, medical strikes have actually taken care of patients. They just won't do certain things like billing. But yes.
Right, exactly.
Right, exactly.
I knew that, and I think he did too, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, he didn't know that you knew that.
I love that weird stuff. I got in trouble with some communist friends of mine for talking crap about the NEA. Not the National Endowment for the Arts, but the National Education Association. For waffling and initially opposing a lot of the basic walkout strikes in like West Virginia, which they did eventually come to the right conclusion, but they didn't at first. They were pretty much forced to. And I got all like, how dare you talk about them? I'm like, dude, but Taft-Hartley changes the nature of unions in the United States.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's why you have to have a sort of left comm rank and file vision for how to be involved in the union, because otherwise you're going to be
good unions, kind of.
yeah.
I mean, the only exception is the IWW, but the IWW is its own thing.
Yeah,
it's actually done some organizing in the last 5 years, which I guess it kind of didn't for 50 in the United States. I know I shouldn't say that out loud, outside of like Portland and California.
We had an active chapter in Austin that publicly shamed a co-op grocery store into letting their members unionize.
They just successfully organized a burger restaurant here in Portland, Oregon, this year. And the management won't recognize the union, but they held a NLRB election and won. IWW is their formal union.
And so, like, I don't want to give the ILWW too much crap, but if you've ever dealt with it, it's not nationally organized very well because it's all volunteer and refuses to do anything about that. And, like, its union dues are archaic. And, like, I actually joined the national but couldn't fully join because no one would put me in contact with the local. And I was like, I want to be on your side, IDW. I really do.
It's the anarchist DSA.
Yeah. But it also has the same hard limit problem as all the other sects. It's about 6,000 people. And that's at a boom. Its trading's pretty good. I don't want to sound like I actually kind of think highly of the DSA. I think it's actually, I mean, not DSA, the IWW, I think it's actually improving, like, a lot. Because, like, from, like, the late 60s to, like, 1999 or something, I don't think it was anything more than a historical reenactment society. And a lot of people get pissed that I said that, but I think it's pretty much unequivocally true.
I think for a lot of the left, at least in the 80s and 90s, that was true. So it's not a particular dig at the Wobblies.
Well, right, Wobblies were more popular than the Marxists. I mean, like, for those of us who were in college in the late 90s, there weren't even trot sects in most schools.
Yeah.
I was in junior high in the late 90s.
I tried to start up a chapter of the Young Communist League on my high school campus in the late 90s. It didn't go anywhere.
I was an anarcho-communist in the late 90s, and so, of course, ended up a right-winger for a while. But,
I was just punk, and I wanted to piss everybody off. And being communist pissed the anarchists off. It pissed the right wingers off. I didn't actually believe in anything.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's fair. In Georgia, I don't know that I would have known the CPUSA existed. And then I met International Answer. When I was like 21 or 22, and they broke me on the inside. So I was never like a member, but just dealing with them like turned me against the left for a long time.
Yeah, I wonder how many people had that experience that are just like lost to us now, because they don't all come back like you did.
Well, I mean, you know, like, you're 37, you know how rare leftists are in our cohort.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's people older than us. Like, I go to DSA meetings and like the people are like 60 or 25. Are
you right? Yeah.
There's like I look around, I'm like, I'm the only person who like is approaching middle age anywhere near here. Apparently, older millennials and Gen X were just not Marxist.
No, not at all. I remember being involved in the ISO and organizing on campuses. I didn't go to college until my late 20s. Mm-hmm. And when I would go to national gatherings and stuff like that, everybody that I would meet would be either early 20s or 40 and older. You know,
or they were like 68ers. Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, poor Generation X, you guys are a lost generation. I feel for you.
Well, I mean, I think we sometimes forget, and I vaguely remember it because I was, what, 11 or 12 when this happened. But I do remember the end of the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah, me too.
It was traumatic. Yeah. And, like, it's hard to explain that to people.
Like, yeah. I was like, what, 6 years old. I was not cognizant of anything except for like Star Wars.
Yeah, I felt good and it was weird. Even as a kid, I kind of intuited this the right way, I think. I felt good when the Berlin Wall fell, but I did not feel good when the Soviet Union fell.
Yeah.
And this is as like an 11-year-old. I couldn't explain to you why, but I was like, something feels bad about this. Like, this doesn't feel like it's actually good.
Hell, Chris, that could pretty much be the way you describe your politics to people now.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
yeah. Absolutely.
It's one of those things where like, I'm not actually even that much of a Soviet defensist. I'm actually like a tick tonight. But at the end of the day, I'm like, but it was a world historical tragedy that it failed. It really was.
Absolutely.
Dude, all you have to do is look at who's running Ukraine to see how terrible the after effects of that demolition was.
Or study modern contemporary Russia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just go read Alexander Dugin. I mean, don't. But like, also, well, if you're going to read Alexander Dugin, you can pirate the PDF very easily. But, you know, also, don't buy it.
It makes me distrust co-ops, because the more I learned about the transition into the current state with the oligarchs, it was a mixture of the co-ops, of the youth co-ops in the Commissol in the late 80s, and the and basically crime lords that were able to do that. But the youth co-ops were the only people with capital, and the crime lords were the only people with force, and they were able to kind of get everyone's parcels when they divvied it out. I've actually really begun to study all that, and it's fascinating. And I've actually been really frustrated with Trotskyists for a long time that we're still having these debates that seem like they're out of the 60s. Have you read Mike McNair's Revolutionary Strategy?
No.
Really should, because the first chapter goes through the way every single Trotskyist prediction was wrong, and why are these people still taken seriously? Even when, you know, they were right about so much else, the main thing that they split about, none of them were correct about. Not a single Trot tendency was.
I think that's how you can account for the present day, not just present day, the headlessness over... I mean, look, like, to be the dissident wing of the movement worldwide and to watch the collapse of the Soviet Union happen and not be able to cobble together a new movement, but to still continue to, like, basically be at the margins, even as the margins, even as the movement itself begin to collapse, just to find new places further out in the margins for the last two decades should say all it says about Trotskyism. Like, its historical mission, it failed, it's over, just give it up.
Okay, so, like, being a Trotskyist in the 30s and 40s makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah, sure.
Being a Trotskyist in the 60s, 70s, whatever. The further you get away from the death of Trotsky, you know, the less sense it makes.
And also, it really depends on where you're at. I'm really fascinated by who represented the dissident form of communism in Europe, for example, because, like, somehow the Maoists got the anti-Stalinist momentum in France, which has never made sense to me. It also makes me just... fundamentally distrust French theory, because I'm like, you've just been really weird on everything. historically, Team Germany all the way.
Well, there is a historical relationship between the Maoist anti-religion sentiment and French anti-Muslim sentiment.
Because it comes, there's this laissez-est stuff. And a lot of Nazbols in France, there are a lot of people attached to the Front National did flirt with that stuff in the 60s, explicitly. And then there was the weird, like, French Frankfurt School turn that all became, like, they were all tied to Greca. Not all of them, but a lot of them were, which you didn't see in Germany. You know what I mean by Greca? That's Debonis. That's European New Rights, like, main think tank.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't know what that was. Like,
So you know a little about Spencer. I have dirt on him because I've met him and I've studied him. His advisor was Paul Gottfried, whose advisor was Marcuse.
No shit.
Yep. Holy shit.
And his thesis, his master's thesis is on Adorno.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So he speaks left very well. Like, he personally, when he started correspondence with me and you, I was beginning to go from, like, just like paleoconservative anti-war person with a kind of socialist bent, which is, you know, primed to go fash, honestly. I just wasn't racist.
That helps.
Yeah, that does help a little bit. And that's what scared me out of it, actually. It's like, hey, this racial stuff is weird. How come so many of you guys make neo-Confederate apologies?
Well, yeah, you know, it's better to have been turned off by that than to be into that and turned off by the rest.
which is a majority of the far right in the United States.
I was going to say that would just make
you Nazis, like, except for all that socialism stuff.
Right, exactly. That's like the Ku Klux Klan and most, like, neo-Nazis. They're not Nazis at all. They're just racists.
Yeah, like, or like even Alex Jones, like, his patriot watchwords going back to Klan leaders in 92. And but he was so good at it in the crazy days of, because you guys remember it better than a lot of people in the DSA, back when we were in the bad anti-Iraq war times, where everybody was like a conspiracy nut.
I mean, oh yeah, loose change. Oh, yeah.
Everybody was
right and left. And
yeah,
I've been listening to a podcast that's been going back over the Alex Jones broadcast from, like, 1998-99. I mean, not
that sounds interesting.
And also 2008 and 2009, they've done both. He had, like, Denis Kucinich on and, like, KRS-One and Tarpley.
I remember KRS-One talking to Alex Jones.
And Tarpley, yeah, he's on the Obama deception. And Tarpley was using socialist code. And, like, they were really – and, you know, this is only, like, a few years after, like, Alex Jones was in that movie Waking Life. People forget that, like, the guy actually really tried to do left entryism and was kind of successful at it. I think that's why, like, the occupies in, like, not in the major urban areas has so much different character. I mean, in the not New York and the Bay, really. Had a different character. Because, like, in Atlanta, they were weird, too. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah, back Dallas, in Texas. Dallas, Austin. Yeah.
Back in Texas, in our student activist circles that we were in, there was a not insignificant portion of the student activists who were just, like, all about Alex Jones. And they were all of them would get just, like, this dead serious look in their eyes and be like, no, but seriously, listen to this. And then put on fucking Alex Jones.
Yeah. I remember having to be like, look, he thinks that there is the thing that's wrong with George Bush is that he is part of a worldwide homosexual Satanist conspiracy. Did you miss that part of Alex Jones?
Yeah, honestly, like, if it were true, maybe, you know, critical support for George Bush.
At least critical military support, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Ouch.
Right, the really funny thing to
be
me
careful
is
when, about that, though, because people actually do have, like, critical support for George Bush now because they don't have any memory.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, yeah, dude, all liberals.
Well, like, and I live in Los Angeles now, so I encounter a lot of that, like, at least Bush was at least something, right? It's like, I can't fathom it. Right, and so people ask, like, why are you, you know, how do you sort of defend this notion of pessimism? It's like, how do you not be aware of even one tenth of everything and not be like a, you know, I don't mean like a nihilist, but a pessimist. No. Of the intellect and maybe of the will too sometimes.
My recent catchphrase was pessimism of the intellect, cynicism of the will.
That's great. That's actually really perfect. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's great.
But in a very real sense, I think pessimism, in some ways, is like the only way to not be delusional and also stay on the left. Because a lot of people who I've been close to, and it would be harder for me to do because I come from kind of a right-wing background, which I think protects me from some of this because I remember they're crazy. I remember how crazy they were. I was around them. I think I've seen a lot of people flip. And Fisher was a similar case to me. I mean, because his relationship to Nick Land, he was actually moving more and more leftward through his, you know, out of like this kind of post-structural. But a lot of people around him flipped. I mean, Land, his mentor, flipped. Although it's weirdly consistent in his thought, actually, if you really trace it, more than he claims. People around me flipped to, people around certain podcast projects and publishing projects, people involved with the North Star, have become Trumpist. Some of them have become Nozballs, effectively. I'm not going to out their names. Because call out culture is part of how they got there, to be frank. It's scary, but it's often the most optimistic, diehard people, who do that. They're not in it, like, they don't come from a class-based position anyway, or it's, like, their ideas are structurally right-wing and they don't know it, and then they wake up one day and, like, all I need is the racism.
yeah, I mean, it's just, like, one or two little elements that you tinker with and you can you get re-energized. That's, like, when you have that kind of, like, blind optimism and you're just continually running into a wall, like, I don't know, like, sometimes you just turn around. You just go the other direction. It's not even difficult to comprehend. But what's important is to recognize the possibility of the reverse happening as well, right? Like, there's this notion that, like, liberals are just socialists who don't know it yet. And, like, to the extent that that's true, it's also true of conservatives.
Yeah.
Like, every working person is a potential socialist. Mm-hmm. But they're not always necessarily appealed to in the same way.
Yeah. Even petty bourgeois people, to be frank. I mean, people were like, forget petty bourgeois. Yes, it's a problem. But, like, they get – Marx talks about them becoming proletarianized.
Oh, that's, yeah, that's the next big economic crash is going to completely just eviscerate what's left of the petty bourgeoisie in the United States, you know, and they're going to be proletarianized. Yep.
They're going to split two ways and maybe slightly more to the right than the left.
Well,
because
I think that's the case.
I think that's because we screwed up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's because of our
fault.
Yeah. It's because of our myopia and grandstanding and like nostalgia rather than like trying to figure out, like, how do we relate to people in this moment and how do we describe the next moment effectively?
Like, why are there more ex-Ron Paulers who are Marxist? Because it actually isn't even that bitch of a jump if you really push it. I mean, yes, there's weird stuff Ron Paul believes, but most Ron Paulers were not deep into the worst elements of Ron Paul if they came in and, like, the Love Revolution book or whatever.
They just wanted to smoke weed and get out of Iraq.
Yeah. I mean, like,
which is like, and it, yeah, that's relatable, you know?
That, you can tell that was kind of our strategy. In 1940.
There's a whole generation of Marxists that came out of that.
Yeah.
No, but it's because, like hyperactivity doesn't appeal to people for very long. Well, and so there has to be more to your politics and your practice than just keep performing the ritual, you know, and keep, issuing calls for things which we can't make happen. I'll never forget. I was in the process of trying to help build a group in Arlington, Texas. I was going to school in Denton, Texas at the time, and we were building a socialist group based on whatever we could. So we weren't going to build like it was like a multi-tenancy student club or whatever. And the very first meeting, one of the guys who ended up being in the later in the International Marxist Tendency, he said the first order of business should be to issue a call for workers' councils in Iraq. And it's like, what about like the third or fourth order of business? But it's like, yeah, like let's just issue a call for a thing that we want to happen, because that's the best we've been able to come up with for so long. We don't even recognize real opportunities or real danger when it comes right in front of us.
Even recognizing the inability to functionally put a call out for a thing, but like a call has to go out across a medium and people have to listen to it. And if you don't have that, then like, what, you know, what are you, that's not even putting out a call.
Yeah. You can post it as a Facebook note.
The case for workers' councils in Iraq by some dude in Texas.
This is one thing that worried me about the DSA strategy, not as locals and not, this is not you, but the national strategy on stuff like abolish ICE or Medicare for All, which I hate that slogan. I do not agree with its substance. But the reason why I hate it is all of those policies can be adopted by liberals, but gutted. There's not a platform really, but there's no program for what they actually mean.
There are no transitional demands.
Yeah. Or even minimum program demands. Like, I was like, hey guys, min-max program wasn't all bad. Like,
I wish that was our problem right now.
No, I was trying to explain the min-max program to a bunch of DSAers, and they were like, what do you mean you had two tiers? I'm like, actually, we probably had like eight tiers. I mean, we're stagist. You're stagist. Yeah. Like, the critique of the Vigrotha program is stagist. Well, how do you think this is going to happen? We're just going to all overthrow everything overnight? Like,
good basically. Like,
well, I mean, when the extent of your political understanding is luxury, gay luxury, space communism memes, then yeah, that's exactly what they think.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The memification of left communism has not been necessarily good for anyone.
No, it hasn't. Also, and sadly, like, that's the wrong horizon. Gay space luxury, whatever. that communism is probably less likely to be our future than it is like in the world of Mad Max. Like, our collectives will win the war. That's the future that we're looking forward to. We're not going to save the world, but we might like salvage portions of it.
We need to all start reading pre-capitalist theories of socialism and collectivism in order to be able to form the new socialist communes that will fight on the desert landscapes in the post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah. Or, you know, if we're lucky, we'll be in, like, water world communism.
Yeah, I have taken a very pessimistic view of green stuff for a long time. And even this is one of my critiques of the Soviet Union, is it's not that it didn't care about ecology, but they sucked at it.
Yeah. They have a really bad track record.
I was actually just thinking about that the other day. Like, you know, thinking about the tragedy of the collapse of the Soviet Union and then how the negative impact of the Soviet Union on the environment and leading us to the point that we're at right now, you know, and
Azerbaijan and Uzbekistan is a kind of a wasteland because
absolutely.
Of Soviet development policy.
Uh-huh. So, you know, they needed some eco-Stalinism.
Yeah. I mean, there's no more Aral Sea. It's gone.
Yeah.
Like, that's a legacy that you can't just have nostalgia for what we, even if you have a mythologized vision of like what, you know, the 20th century experience was, you can't just have nostalgia for it and say we want to reproduce it, because like some of that stuff, even at its best, like some of its stuff is just like, it's not, it's not workable. It's not desirable to do a second time around.
Yeah, I was talking about
Gosplan. And we won't get a third time.
Yeah, no. I was talking about Gosplan. Someone's like, Gosplan might have worked in its early socialist calculation formulas if they ever got good numbers, but when people are afraid you're going to shoot them, they lie.
I would lie. Like, I would absolutely be a liar.
Yeah. Yes, me too.
I mean, you know, that's something I got from TickTick. I'm like, their planning might have been sound. We have no idea. They didn't have good inputs. So, you know, if you can't do, I mean, I know I sound like an information problem hack when I say that, but I actually do think that was a large part of the issue.
It's a massive part of the issue. But the other part of the issue, well, whatever. In my opinion, another major massive part of half of the issue was the necessity of competing with the capitalist world. To outproduce and compete militarily, like that's, you know, it compelled the Soviet Union to be productivist as it was.
I'm one of those dissident Leninists who, I actually am a post-Leninist at this point, but even when I was a Leninist, I dated the betrayal of the revolution by accident to 1921, not 1927. Because that's when the expansionist policy.
NEP, yeah.
And it's not the NEP. I'm actually not even that. I don't have that huge problem with the NEP. It was when they compromised on expanding, when they stopped pushing with Poland. And I know why they did it. Because when the German Revolution failed, if the Soviets didn't try to push more into Europe, they were pretty much going to get stalled out.
I mean, they knew it. Like in 1919, they said as much.
Right. And they made a choice of necessity, even. But my biggest problem with Stalinists has always been even when they're right about the necessity, they keep on saying it was a good thing. Like, you might have been right about what you had to do, but the fact you got to that point is a problem.
Right.
The reason I could never take Stalinists seriously was because they have a complete inability to ever admit that any decision made by the Soviet Union was a bad idea, and that includes killing off all of the Bolsheviks. You know, single last one of them was a fascist collaborator. You know,
splitting Poland in half with Nazi Germany was not even a mistake. It was necessary to create a buffer zone with Nazi Germany by establishing a hard border between the USSR and Nazi Germany.
Well, think about it, though. If they didn't take that half of Poland, just what is the distance between the border of Poland and the border of the USSR? And that would have put him right in Moscow.
Yeah. If only
Bukharin
and Trotsky had been friends.
honestly, that's not even too far off from what I actually think.
I do admit that I think Bukharin made some mistakes in the second instantiation of the NEP. But and also he picked the wrong side. But
yep,
I actually think Bukharin was a sounder thinker than Trotsky, and I really respect Trotsky. But that's one of the most depressing Soviet what ifs. Is like, what if Bukharin had just been a little better, or he had been the successor to Lenin and not?
Well, you know, that's the role of the individual in history, right? You know, Bukharin acted as a representative of a whole historic possibility that was not to be.
Yeah, sadly. I mean, the other thing is we have to stop thinking about socialist heroes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my big thing about all of us now is we all have our, you know, I remember reading one of the only David Graeber quotes I like, but I actually do think it's true. It's like, if you look at your Marxist tendencies, it is ironic that they start off as revolutionary members, become statesmen, and by the end of it, they're obscure professors in France. And
ouch. It's true.
I was like, true. Then he goes on to say, but, you know, anarchists, they say what they really are in their adjectives. And I started laughing I don't know anything when someone tells me they're an anarchist.
Yeah, it's all of the it's the hyphened part. Yeah. The other reason why we need to make sure that we have to get away from having socialist heroes is I don't know if you've ever read the correspondence of Marx and Engels or Rosa Luxemburg, but I'm horrified to think of some of our correspondence being read by future generations.
Oh God! Oh Jesus!
I have to make it a point to never do anything of note because my text messages really need to go away when I die.
were my Facebook arguments that I had with people who criticized the ISO in the mid-2000s.
yeah, no, for real. Oh, God. You know, it's funny. I mean, that's another thing, though, that I dislike about our more... I know there's some communists who totally detest moralism. I actually think that may be a little bit too far. But there is a tendency to... like having, you know, whatever Marx said was right. And I tend to think that about his arguments, but I've read his personal letters.
Yeah.
Dude had moments where he would say, like, outright reactionary things. Some of the stuff he said about LaSalle really is a little bit unforgivable, particularly
absolutely. Since
it all could apply to him, too. And he did have the sense not to say them in public in a time where you could have. But the point is, like, if you go into any socialist dude's project, you're going to find dirt. Women too, and the sanctification of these figures as figures and not as thinkers and theorists and statesmen or whatever is part of the issue. And I will say liberals are actually better than us at this until recently, until the Hamilton musical, but like
you mean the death of culture.
I mean, he's got me like that musical had me wearing a shirt that said Aaron Burr did nothing wrong. Like, God, like, I know it's a
is that a real shirt?
I made it.
Okay, I need that's that awesome. Shirt
because I'm like, I know he's a bourgeois revolutionary, but he's like kind of the worst one. I'm like,
oh yeah,
yeah.
Aaron Burr was at least cool enough to come up with an idea of you know, breaking away from the United States and starting his own country,
right? And no. Like, whom amongst us wouldn't want to do that?
Yeah, I know, right?
I also like, I was reading a book on the anti-federalists and remembering that communists do think some of the anti-federalist arguments were more progressive. I was reading a communist book on them, actually. I can't find it. I was like, oh, wow, that some of the communists did realize that the anti-federalists sort of had a working a proto-working class, really yeoman class point.
What is that book?
What is it? Criticisms of the Constitution?
That's not what I'm thinking of.
There's a couple of them, actually.
Yeah.
This one collects and has socialist commentary on criticism of the Constitution, including the anti-federalist, and there's a socialist reading of all the anti-federalist stuff in it, which is really good. It's by Bertal, I think. Anyway, a Marxist humanist guy. I'm really good at giving everybody more reading than they could possibly do. So.
No, it's great. You know, I might not get to it for a while, but it's there.
Well, you guys actually brought up some stuff I hadn't read, because I thought I'd read like everything on like fascism, and then you were this post-fascist stuff. I'm like, I have come to a similar conclusion, but I have not read this. So I was happy about that.
I'm really looking forward to the Traverso book that comes out in January.
Oh yeah,
I want to do a book review episode. Of that. Well, maybe I do. I don't know. It might end up sucking and then I won't want to, but you know, I assume that it won't.
Yeah. I always do book review episodes thinking the books are going to be better.
Mm.
So, I read the Micro
Hayden. That's where you need that revolutionary pessimism.
Yeah. You know,
they won't be so disappointed. No books are good.
Look, I'm looking forward to reading this book. It's going to suck, but I'm going to read it. Yeah. That's how I watch movies. Yeah. And I'm very rarely surprised.
When I become super Nilecom almost, I'm always like, I have my sad Dorno face on. Like, everything is fascist. It's all bad.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that is the thesis of, what's the author? Jonathan Bowden's Pulp Fascism.
Yeah.
Is that, like, you know, like, Western culture is so thoroughly saturated with fascistic themes, like, that the ground in which you sow the seeds of fascism is, like, already ripe. Harvest at any moment.
I think that's why the alt-right likes Adorno, not because they agree with Adorno, but what Adorno thinks is Hotel Grand Abyss, they're like, but it's good.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So Adorno flipped on his head.
Oh, God, yeah. So Adorno flipped on his head. Oh, that's terrible. Fucking.
Well, look, that's what we came here welcome. To do, is to make you feel bad.
Yeah, you out-pessimist me. I used to be the grand pessimist of left-wing podcasting. Also, because I've done it for so long.
Yeah, well, that'll do it for you.
Yeah, man. I mean, you know what, though? We're in a heyday right now, and I'm actually upset about that. Like, I remember,
this heyday fucking sucks, man.
I remember when there was, like, three of us, and, like, Diet Soap, us, and, like, seeing red radio or something like, and then from Alpha to Omega, those have like Chapo people I know have listened to them. I've discovered this from subreddits, but yeah. And the only other thing available is like Democracy Now, and everything else was libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
And like there aren't libertarian podcasts anymore, really. So it's like,
well, they've all gotten kicked off the big podcast mediums for being racist.
Well, yeah. Here's the weird thing. Like, yeah, there have been libertarian crypto racists for a long time, but there were legit anti-racist libertarians in the mid to late aughts. What happened to them? Do they all just write for Reason now, or they all just become like something else? Are they all like liberals? Like,
I think it's hard to sustain the position. I think what you just described is that they all evolved into something else. Maybe not all on the same trajectory though.
Anecdotally, I had three friends that I grew up with that were libertarians whenever they came of age to be into politics that are now just liberals.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think a lot more of them become liberals than people realize, because everyone's like, oh, they became all out rightist. I'm like, I don't think that. They were a lot more of them than...
Oh, no, but like everyone that was a solid principled right winger became a fascist of some sort, a post-fascist of some sort, you know? Libertarians don't even really exist anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, Reason Magazine's trying to hold out the good fight, but...
They're establishing a political center.
Yeah. At this point in libertarianism, they're the center left.
yeah, seriously.
Which is kind of... I mean, like, when I'm like, oh my god, the Koch brothers are moderates now. What a bizarro world I live in.
Yeah.
A time of monsters, you might say.
Yeah.
I'm hoping this century isn't as regrettable as the last one, but like...
Well, you know, that's kind of the whole point is, you know, which century are we even talking about here?
Exactly. Right. No, I, as soon as I saw your title, I was like, I'm going to like these guys probably. and then I listened to your podcast, like, oh, this is really good. And I was like, this is going to have to change my motto. Don't ever trust a Cliffite.
hey, we are reformed Cliffites.
Yeah,
I know, that's what they all say. No, I actually don't even really feel that way, but it's funny. The ISO, I one time personally ticked off someone high up, and they like sent people to like harass my blog and something. It was back when I worked for the North Star.
Yeah, I think there was like a formal policy around like internet dog piles when somebody in leadership got mad at somebody. It was like, send out the troops, you know.
For me, it was guilt by association. The guy who founded the North Star at that time was tied to Louis Project, who I personally don't get along with and kind of hate.
Oh yeah, no one gets along with that fucking dude.
Yeah, he wrote a hit piece on me where he took a bunch of stuff that other people said and like attributed it to me, and I was like, look, I have a right wing past. You think you could like find better dirt than like attributing the wrong things to my? But you can look like, unfortunately, if you get to the second page, like a lot of the stuff I do is poetry and then a bunch of podcasts, and you'll find this Project hit piece, you know, like called Wither the North Star, and it's all about me. Except he's got most of his
facts. Oh. I feel like I remember that piece. Yeah, I don't remember.
That's me.
I remember the title anyways. That's funny.
Nice.
I have to say.
That's a badge of honor, man.
Yeah. I'm going to go back and read that piece now and form all kinds of opinions about
read
you.
Read the comments, because the comments are funny, because people are like, you know, he didn't say that right. You're attributing someone else's words to him. And all these people were writing, you know, under fake names. And I was at first because of I lived in South Korea, where it's technically illegal to be a Marxist and I could be deported for it.
Oh, it's cool. I'm going to try to guess which one is you when I read it.
I'm open about it at the time that I'm writing that, but it's just hilarious because, but anyway, the ISO also, the guy that Project worked with was this guy named Pham Binh.
Yeah.
Stuff got a little crazy with him. The ISO was like, you work for Pham Binh, therefore bad. Cause he wrote this kind of hit piece on the ISO that wasn't fair.
No, I remember that. Yeah.
And so they're like, I was guilt by association.
wait, you're telling me that somebody on the left used guilt by association?
Yeah,
I'm shocked.
Crazy times, man.
What's funny is, again, I'm also like, don't you know, like, I'm like, dude, I met Richard Spencer once. If you want to get guilt by association, you can do better than that.
That's true. That's really low hanging fruit there, man.
But there is this tendency. I'm glad you brought that up about redeeming conservatives. There is this tendency to be like, once right, always right.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And what I've found interesting is most leftists who come from the right do not go back. It's pretty rare for someone to flip and flip back.
That's a very sort of Spanish Catholic view to take, you know, like Moriscos and, you know, basically thinking that all Muslims and Jews were just that converted to Christianity were just faking it and going to go back. Yeah.
We're all right Muranos.
Yeah, exactly.
There is that idea, and I have been like very few people who come out of who actually break from that, because look, it's hard to break, because I'm not going to lie, there's more money on the right.
Oh yeah,
I've had you know, I was writing a book with Michael Rettenroll before he went crazy, and
really,
yeah, oh yeah, on religion.
Interesting, yeah.
And then he went nutso for, but like he's making way more money, so you know.
Yeah, I'm not making any money.
So, if the incentives just aren't there, if you got out of that world, it's usually because some moral reason or some class reason, one of the two, and very rarely the other way. Because like, if you're a celebrity leftist, I can tell you that there's a pattern. X right wing position is actually left wing, and then OMG, the right isn't all wrong. Hey, look, I'm getting a fat paycheck complaining about SJWs.
Yeah, it's a very short road, actually.
Like you'll make a ton of money doing that. You can get the New York Times writing about you.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because they love a good story of a person's God that failed moment, you know.
I call it the Whitaker Chambers problem.
I don't think I know the story. Whitaker Chambers,
the guy who wrote Perjury and accused Alger Hiss of being a spy, which, by the way, he was. If you actually read the before he was a conservative, probably a gay man and became religious, he got attacked for that on the left. And then he went to other leftists and to talk about Hiss, and then some other people who, like, he knew people who got abducted by the Comintern, like, outright. And this has now been confirmed in the Soviet archives. It happened. He wasn't lying. And then they shunned him. Then he went to liberals and they shunned him, particularly after the FDR times. And so the only people who talked to him were like religious people who were anti-communist. And he became that. Which is not to say that the part of that wasn't in him in some way. But like, there's also an incentive factor that we on the left often reinforce by our reactions.
Absolutely. I've had this conversation with some close friends actually fairly recently about the need to recognize that there is such a thing as contested territory, and not regard anything that's not anyone or anything, any space that's not like purely in your camp as part of the enemy. As soon as you do that, you're writing off so many people who haven't figured it out yet or could change.
Well, what's that Malcolm X quote? I mean, I'm mixing them up now. I'm thinking of the one where he talks about like not being too quick to judge people who are hold positions that you held yourself yesterday.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think the other thing, everybody's favorite is a DSA 21-year-old who, you know, a year ago was a Bernie Sandersite and now is like somehow convinced themselves that they're a hardcore Maoist. Interesting Galanzo thought. As a side note, one of the truly regrettable things of our time is the fact that someone's trying to redeem Shining Path thought. Like,
yeah,
what?
That's real. Of Red Guards Austin, RA thing.
I've encountered the Red Guards Austin. They're particular individuals. I'll say that much.
Yes, they are some. Folks.
Resurrecting Galanzo thought. I mean, like, I guess killing peasants for no reason is your thing. There's no peasants to kill around here, so.
Well, that's why it won't take off, so we don't have to worry about it.
At the same time, one of the things I've been worried about myself, and this will be the last question, and you guys can talk about it, is the danger of becoming, like, the leftist critique of the left crank, who... they're almost right wingers, like, and you know people like this, like left contrarians. I think of Spiked, you know, like in the UK. And how do you avoid that? Because this is something I personally struggle with.
honestly, being, I think, as the only antidote to that is just being involved on the ground in movements. As much unrewarding work as it might be, like seeing what it is that you're actually fighting for instead of just reading about it, you know? And it's something to me that I think will sort of inoculate you against that sort of crankism, hopefully. I don't know.
I think that there's partly I agree with that. That's part of it for sure. But I definitely know some different kinds of cranks. I've met people who joined the SWP in the 70s and they're still members, and they're just a different kind of crank. And I never want to be one of those either. No, what I think might have, what has helped rescue me from that so far anyways, has been I rediscovered those suspicious French philosophers, like in the form of the existentialists, and and there's not enough space in here to talk about, like, you know, some of the more esoteric situationist theories about, like, you know, psychogeography and, like, whatever. But I actually find a lot of, like, sort of regenerative value in, oh, how do I want to put this? Like, there's a lot to the self that, you know, you can be, like, personally responsible for, and that you can sort of, like, yes, I do think we have to be involved. That's why I am involved. But I'm also involved in a way which is, like, I allow space for myself to just, like, I am just going to sort of traverse the hellscape and ponder it and reflect on it and try to find a little bit of meaning personally in my own activities once in a while. And hopefully the balance between those two things will keep me from burning out or becoming a crank or becoming a right winger. But it remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think there is no answer. There is no magic bullet. There is no guarantee that you won't become a crank, that you won't burn out, and that you won't become a right winger. I think we have to embrace that reality that the future isn't written. Everything is contingent. Change is the only constant.
Guy Debord's last 4 years are really sad and go into Red-Brown Alliance territory and then suicide. So
and lots of conspiracy theories. And, you know, with any luck at all, we get to die in the revolution.
That's one of the things I was going to say is holding on to a romanticism of death by firing squad will help you keep from becoming a crank.
And the really cool thing about the last century that we know is that no matter who wins, people like us will die in a firing squad.
Yeah, kind of. It's a damned if you do, damned if you win.
That's right. We're here to be the conscience of the revolution until it kills its conscience.
Oh man, don't make Hannah Arendt right. Please don't make Hannah Arendt right. That's my worst fear, that Hannah Arendt was really right the whole time. That's worse than right wing. That's worse than burnout. That...
Fuck, I never even considered that possibility.
All right, guys. Well, I'm going to have to let you go.
Hey, yeah, it's been great.
Thanks so much for letting us come on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever-faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon accounts for additional episodes. Have a good day. Thank you.